Hello, it's Clancy Overall here. G'day. Something a bit different. It's not when we usually would publish our podcast. It's neither a bulletin or an interview. It's actually got nothing to do with me, myself, Clancy Overall, the rest of the newsroom here at the Batuta Advocate. But we thought we'd kind of showcase what else has been happening in and around Batuta. And that is, you might remember 6 or 7 weeks ago, we interviewed a young bloke by the name of Alexi Toliopoulos. That was for our 2024 Oscars analysis podcast. You can go back and listen to that if you are interested in any way still in the Oscars, which was, you know, a couple months ago. But we had a great yarn with Alexi, who is a film cinephile, I guess, a film critic, a film buff, actually just a freak, a Greek freak of cinema. And he, you know, he kind of has developed a bit of a name in Australia as perhaps the go-to guy. They used to be, you know, Margaret and David were on the ABC and everyone used to listen to them and you know, they were an authority on film. I feel like Alexi's in that space now where I do trust what he says about films, about great performances, about great shows, about great, you know, cinematography, great soundtracks. He's the one that can tell you all of that. And I feel like he is an expert. Now, he's got a podcast with Batuta called The Last Video Store. So the premise is, and I'll map it out for you, Alexi is the video store clerk. And what happens is people will come in as customers. High-profile Australians will come into The Last Video Store, which is in Batuta, and try and rent out videos. If anyone can remember that experience, it's a very warm and loving nostalgic memory that we all have heading to the video store on Friday night. This is the premise. High profile guests come in to The Last Video Store in Batuta and they have with them three films. They have a new release, a film that they've enjoyed or they have heard a lot about in the new release. That's something that's come out recently. And they bring with them their all-time favorites. That's two weeklies, they're called. So one new film, two of the all-time favorites. That's what they bring to the table. And Alexi, as the video store clerk, discusses all of those films, all of the performances, all the inside gossip, all of the different industry kind of chit-chat that you kind of miss as someone who likes films, you know, casually or, you know, a partial to a good film or a good movie. You don't really know what's gone on in making them. You don't really know what this director's done before. You don't really know what this actor's done before. You don't know who funded it. You don't know why you can't access it anymore, where it is on streaming. Do we have the rights to see it in Australia? There's plenty of films like that out there, and Alexi has seen them all. He's seen every single film. So that's the premise, really. And then he finishes his chit-chat with these you know, high-profile customers. You know, you've had the likes of Polly Bennett, Luke Bracey. Polly Bennett was the movement coach and choreographer for Saltburn and The Crown and Elvis. And we have Luke Bracey from Elvis as well. Plenty of comedians and, you know, Australia. Peter Hellier was on there the other day, actually. I found that quite interesting because I never took him for a proper cinephile. I took him as a, you know, TV host, radio stand-up comedian. But, yeah, he had a lot to say about Korean cinema. Yeah, I learned a lot about Peter in that episode. But yeah, at the end of this kind of conversation, what happens is Alexi will give these guests a staff pick, a film they haven't seen before that only he could possibly know about based on a combination. He triangulates the films they bring in, you know. So they've got their new release and they've got their all-time favorites. And Alexi looks at that and he says, I think you'll like this film. And he's very, very good at that. And this is the beauty of the podcast. This is why we're going to play an episode of it for you today. And today's episode, it's Alexi talking with an old friend of Batuta, the Australian country music icon, Troy Cassidaly, the Bundjalung Falcon, as we call him in Batuta. You know, Troy's lived a very interesting life between Surry Hills and Grafton, Maltese, Koori background, you know, something that he's been able to completely communicate through his country music and through his storytelling and song. But, you know, to see the side of Troy Cassidaly where it's you know, him expressing himself through his favorite films. I just found it very interesting. I think Alexi and him got on a level. Alexi can talk to anyone about this stuff. So please tune in. Listen to this episode. I've gone on a bit here, but this is just me singing praises for it. This is introducing to you, listeners at home, the last video store in Batuta with Alexi Toliopoulos and Troy Cassadaly. Enjoy.
Troy Cassadaly, thank you for joining me inside the last video store.
It's incredible. It's actually giving me so many flashbacks here. I'm just loving every minute of this.
I'm seeing goosebumps grow across your skin right now. You're being taken back, transported to another world.
It's another world, isn't it?
Yeah.
Another world.
Inspecting the tapes, inspecting the discs. Are you a film fan?
Look, I am, through my son. Mm-hmm. I live vicariously through him. He's 26. But when he was a little fella, he started getting right into Ray Harryhausen.
Oh,
getting into Jason the Argonauts.
I love that. So like those old school sword and sandals. We've got the monsters.
Yeah,
we've got
very, very jittery movement. Mm. And there were so many things that he introduced me to as a little child.
Yeah.
And then when he started to insist we go to this place called Trash Video, mm-hmm. someone had told him about it.
In Brisbane, right?
In Brisbane. Mm-hmm. And we'd go across town. We'd have all-you-can-eat sushi with both kids.
Yeah.
And then they'd both get to pick one or two videos each and then take them for the week. And everything of Clay's was always about Godzilla, always the wackiest movies. Yeah. And we still have the same taste. I mean, if I really didn't have enough choices to really fill all the gaps. I mean, there's one that Stephen King had out called Christine, The Car That Kills, right?
And you're a car guy, of course.
Car guy. So Clay and I, he calls his red SS Commodore Christine. So, yeah, look, I'm a music fan, but Clay really got me involved in movies early in the piece. Yeah.
Yeah. When I think about, like, what I love about film and film storytelling, I think Roger Ebert put it really well. He called film the empathy machine, that is something that can, like, transport you to other worlds and experience other existences.
It's so true.
Yeah. Mm. And I think your storytelling as a songwriter, as a singer, definitely contains that same kind of power.
Oh, thank you. Look, I really do love the fact that we are able to carry on something that we've been having in our family for a long, long time. Mm. And hearing stories we thought was just normal when we were growing up, especially around Grafton, or camping, around fires. And that storytelling made its way from my campfire into this, even in this latest record.
Yeah.
And I really do feel proud of that. And I think as I get older, I've grown to realise there's a responsibility as coming into like a younger elder.
Yeah.
That the storytelling's vital.
Yeah.
And it's all oral, but I get a chance to actually put it down on CD.
Yeah. They love that. CDs are the new oral history.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
We know to sign you up to this video store, I'm going to need a little piece of ID and your new album, Between the Fires. I think that's a beautiful piece of ID that will log into our system here.
Thank you.
I want to ask you about it as well, because we're talking about like this idea of storytelling. And for this album, you returned to your mother's home, your late mother's home, to record it. And I found it so moving. It's so personal, this album. But what I'd love to hear your thoughts about is that idea of empathy and how you think music can kind of be a vehicle for belonging, especially belonging to country.
Well, look, definitely there's a big connection to country through this record. Being recorded on Goombanga country, which is my mum and my grandmother's country, it was really such a natural fit to be able to go out there, loom an old house out in the middle of 90 acres and cut a record.
Yeah,
I never thought I'd ever get to do it. But there was this huge connection when everyone arrived as well. And when all the band and the crew got out of the hire cars, I ran them through a big bunch of smoke and gave them a cleanse before they walked into the house. And my job all the way through the record was cutting some old bush timber out of old stumps and keeping that smoke going every day.
Oh, wow.
So it was a continual cleanse, but it was also a connection. And at the end of the project, I went to the fire, dug out a whole big bunch of ash, put it into some little bottles, and I sent it to each of the band with a little bit of that and a little piece of a painting. And I sent them the picture of the big painting that I'd done, and I cut the painting up that I printed and put it on each little bottle. And they said the connection for them, even though they're obviously, you know, non-Indigenous people, was huge. And that made me feel really proud.
Wow. I love hearing you talk about that. There's one lyric that you have in your song Old Road Home from this new album that I think completely embodies that feeling of the connection of self to the connection of place and the connection of the spirituality of it.
Yes.
And it's the lyric, "If memories were rivers, I'd drown and I'd go down smiling."
Oh, totally. And when I was writing that song, I remember going down toward Grafton, and I was on my way down. I thought, well, I could either go straight to Halfway Creek on that new road, or I can turn up Big River Way and go the old road home. And just for old time's sake.
Yeah.
And as soon as I turned onto the old road, the memories started.
Yeah.
And they were flowing.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, if they were rivers, I'd be up to my head now. But talk about make me happy. Every mile a memory.
Yeah.
And it was just wonderful to be able to have the freedom when you're sitting in the car by yourself just to get to understand why you're feeling that way. Mm. And it was nostalgic and some of it was sad, but there was this happiness, this overwhelming happiness to say, here I am, I'm driving down as a 52-year-old man at the time and I'm going, this is just where I want to be.
Yeah.
Right back on the North Coast and back to where I started.
How do you think that connection and that sense of belonging to country is changing for young people in places like Grafton now?
Look, I think it's changing because of the way that the social media aspect is now. A lot of kids will spend a lot more time looking at maybe their cousins and friends and live vicariously through them jumping into rivers and diving for turtles.
Yeah.
Whereas we sometimes forget that the real experience of doing that is tenfold compared to watching someone do it on a phone.
Yeah.
And I used to have to tell myself to stop living vicariously through my family at home and I'd see them going down to Woolleye or going to Yamba or catching fish at Turner's Beach. And I think to myself, no, I'm going back to do that. I'll go back to Station Creek, go back to Red Rock and do it myself. And it was worth the trip. You get in the car, 3.5 hours, you're door to door. And it was like, that's my connection. I think kids just lose their connection because they don't take as much time with their old people and don't take as much time to go and have a cup of tea with an old auntie. But when I go home, Fettingham, it's a lot of visiting and a lot of sitting around. And I like that.
Yeah.
I like the fact that there's connection. And I'll say to my wife, look, I'm going home for a week. You don't have to come with me. I said, because I'm going visiting, cups of tea, have the men's camp. Then I'm going to do a little mini show at the Halfway Creek Hall near where I recorded the record.
Yeah.
Just to say thanks to the fire brigade for looking after us because we had some fires during the recording.
Yeah.
And so it's just a little bit of paying things forward.
Yeah. You know? Well, in the interest of paying things forward and paying things back to your predecessors, my dad, Dr. Richie, is a huge fan of yours.
Wow.
Like truly, he's a bit obsessed with you, I would say. Not in a dangerous way, don't worry, not in a dangerous way. But he grew up as well, like in Grafton, the same area as you. And my dad's a professor of human geography, which is like the study, it's like anthropology, you study people and their connection to the place they live and the land. So I said he could ask you one question. He sent it in to me.
Yes.
And I had to put it up that way because
fascinating. Wow.
So he's got a question for you and it's a great question. It's about his favorite song of yours. And I think one of the great songs in Australian music history, Shadows on the Hill.
Oh, okay.
He says, "Your song, Shadows on the Hill, is wonderfully challenging. I do wonder if you have a sense of what you hope white fellas and people who've made the southern continent their home might hear in, learn from, or do in response to the song and the lived experiences it reflects." Intense question from a dear fan.
No, I think it's a great question. And what I was hoping was not to scare people. I wanted them to hear and get into the song with me.
Yeah.
And I was rehearsing with Ian Moss to do the Red Hot Summer Tour, which was about 27 shows over about, 15, 16 weekends.
Yeah.
And we're putting our set list together and Ian said, "You have to put Shadows on the Hill in this set." And I said, "How will a slow song like that go over at a rock festival where you've got, 5 to 10, 15,000 people?" And Ian said, "People need to hear it," right? So I started putting it in. And what I would do is say, this started as our story around our fire, because we had a bit of an epiphany moment where had a cousin that was going through the last stages of stage four cancer. We had him up on country. We were catching turtles. We were doing the things we used to do when we were kids. And to break the monotony of the sadness, we said, hey, listen, why did Nan not let us go across the river over there? You know, why were we always, you know, pushed away? And my uncle stood up and said, that's because she had heard there was a huge massacre of Goombanga people on that side of the river. And when he said that, the calm that came around that camp was amazing. The birds stopped singing. Mm. The wind stopped blowing.
Wow.
And we all looked at each other and went, ooh, something very heavy's happening here. And my uncle stood back up and he said, the old people know we're here and not to be scared. And as he said that, I looked up on the hill and there were three old trees that looked like old people standing there with their shadows being cast down the hill. And I thought, this deserves a song. Wow. And then every time we'd play it at the Red Hot Summer, it would just stop the crowd in their tracks.
Wow.
And Ian loved it because he was able to embellish it himself with things as well. Mm. And he really loved the feeling of the song. But he also knew that it was a part of everyone's education as well, part of mine. And I didn't know that story until my uncle told me. And so I walked away from there full of inspiration, but full of enthusiasm to share that story from that campfire then with everyone. And every person in this country I class as family.
Mm.
And I take that very seriously because I think everyone has a responsibility to look after our country, whether you're black or white.
Yeah.
So it's a song for everyone.
Absolutely.
And you know, we can learn.
Performing alive, you must feel like this absolute atmosphere shift, like this change.
It is crazy. I've done it in some really, really special places. Did it at Uluru a couple of years ago.
Wow.
And one of the old elders from Mutajulu there, he came over and he said, boy, that song about the shadows, wow. And I said, oh, thank you, Unc. He said, no, it's happened everywhere. He said, it's happened everywhere, but at least you're talking about it.
Yeah.
So it's pretty important.
Wow. Pretty important.
And then you know, Briggs gets in touch with me and says, Unc, do you mind if I put a beat to this? I said, because I think this has got another whole heap of depth that I can take it to for a my new audience. Life
as well. Yeah.
And I said, feel free. And he sent me through this beautiful track that he did up. And I just went, wow, this is going to be incredible. And then he sent the rap.
Yeah.
And my mum said, did he really have to swear in it? And I said, Mum, he's a rap act.
Yeah.
Of course he has to swear. Yeah. And my mum could swear with the best of them, you know. Yeah. But and because I think she was a bit more connected to the song because it was mine.
Yeah.
But to hear it come back and to hear the power is something that I knew that the seed that I'd planted as an older generation bloke was able to then go to someone like Briggs, and he took that seed and that plant and made it something else.
Yeah, and it's all about communication, right?
Yeah, and it's a songline. That
story, yeah.
You know, for me,
yeah,
it was a songline that was handed on to the next generation, and he took it into his own world.
Wow.
So it was pretty cool.
Well, beautiful answer, and I'm sure that's put me strong held up in the wheel for that one, so I appreciate that. Well, you know what? I've put your album through. Your ID between the fires has checked out.
Right, good.
So you have signed up to the store officially.
I love it.
You've got access to our new member combo now, Troy. So you can head on out to the shelves, pick up three flicks. You're going to get a new release, a combo of two weeklies. And then I'm going to bestow upon you a little gift from me to you of a staff pick recommendation based on your taste.
Okay. So well, that'll be out. Good. That'll be good.
All awesome. Good. Hopefully you feel some nostalgia. Come back in.
I sure will.
Weekly. Wow, Troy, you've got a beautiful stack of movies here. Some deep emotions absolutely radiating from your pile here right now.
I can't believe you've got these here. The Color Purple. I have to say, when I first saw it, I was sitting with my mum.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, I've heard this Steven Spielberg film.
Mm-hmm.
It's about slavery. It's about the South.
Yeah.
And really, really, she was dead keen to watch it.
Yeah.
So it finally came on TV, you know, and I thought to myself, wow, I'm buying that DVD, which I think Mum still has at home.
You've still got the DVD still in got possession. The
DVD at home, yeah. And actually, I think it's a video.
Oh, okay, even better. I think
it's a video.
Even better.
And it was so moving. And Whoopi Goldberg and Danny Glover, I think their roles were like spectacular because I didn't realise that there were those sorts of dynamics happening in the African American world.
Mm.
We often draw comparisons between Indigenous people throughout the world,
yeah,
here Native Americans, but I hadn't really understood the dynamics. I'd watched things like Roots when I was a kid, but until I saw this, I didn't realize there was like spousal violence, all that sort of thing that was going on in this movie. Confronting, but when she finally gets a chance to meet up with her sister at the end again and stuff like that, was really liberating.
Yeah.
For my mum was a pretty powerful black woman, and she saw a lot of herself, I think, in Whoopi Goldberg too, her character.
And I think one thing that like persists with me for this film, because it has like a strange reputation, this film, because it's obviously it's very moving, very powerful, and it is quite beautifully made by Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
But even at the time of release, there was controversy around, is this the right person to be telling this story? And I think that's kind of the way it sat with me over the years, going like, oh, I love Spielberg, but I always thought this was a strange choice or an odd fit for him. Having gone back and revisiting it not too long ago, you go on this journey of then going like, oh, wow, no, he does bring this interesting quality to it. And if not him, the biggest filmmaker in the world, would this film have been made? Because at this point in history, Hollywood is not making movies about strong black women at all.
No. And also Oprah Winfrey,
mm-hmm.
who played an incredible part, was someone that we didn't know as anyone but that character in there in the movie.
Yeah.
She hadn't gone on to do all the Oprah Winfrey things.
Yeah.
So she was just this sort of unknown actress that came through Spielberg cast her,
mm-hmm.
and just her determination and her will to stand up for herself and her kids,
yeah.
and the color of her skin was something else.
Yeah.
And Mum and I were very moved by her as well. So it's probably my number one movie.
Wow, this is your number one of all time.
This is it.
Wow, I love that.
And when I see the cover again, I think to myself, wow. I remember seeing the video at home at Mum's place, thinking to myself, we used to always had to pick our times to watch it because of its nature.
Yeah.
But
you can't just chuck this on a Saturday morning.
No.
You got to sit down with this one.
You really got to immerse yourself in it. Yeah. You know, and I think for me, the reason it came in at number one was the emotion. Indigenous people are very emotional people, and we love the saddest of sad country songs, and we love sad movies.
Yeah.
And that's the one that got me and got my mother all the way. And I'm so glad you had it here.
Yeah.
And like I say, it was my first pick. When I actually got a choice, I thought, you know, I'm going there.
Straight away. I'll tell you another thing in retrospect that I really appreciate about this movie. It is like the film debut of one of the great talents, Whoopi Goldberg, as well. And it's such an interesting performance because there is this, she captures like the absolute, I don't know how else to say, but like the sadness of this character and how held in this character is, how reserved they are, how forced they are to be reserved. And when you go back to it after seeing Whoopi Goldberg on your screen for, you know, 40 years now, and you see the difference of who she can be and who she is in this film, it holds even more power because you go, well, this is who she could have been if she wasn't held captive like this.
Well, she had this subservient role and she was like a second choice to come in because our mate's wife had died.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, I just felt her pain when I looked at the character, and my mum and I were just sort of going, wow, how do you live through this?
Yeah.
How do you survive?
Yeah.
And, you know, getting her little sister to move on before Danny Glover was jumping all over her as well was something that, you know, we didn't know whether she'd escape either, you know. And old mate having his little girl on the side, the Sug Avery, I think her name was.
Sug Avery, that's,
you know,
her.
And we were all going, oh, you know, that floozy.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was always like she was always looked upon as the ugly, you'll do woman.
Mm.
And the power in that just spoke volumes to me, even as a kid. Do you know what year? I don't even know what year this came out.
85, I think.
Well, 85, I was in my last year of high school.
Mm.
I was in year 10. And I don't know. I was a pretty emotional kid, I suppose, losing grandparents and uncles and aunties early in the piece.
Yeah.
That movie spoke to us for some reason.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
No, I don't think it's weird at all, because it's like you're talking about the connection. It's so raw. It's so there.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that's really interesting about this film as well, it is one of the rare films directed by Steven Spielberg that does not have a score by John Williams.
Well, that's right. And I mean, when you said, was he the right bloke to be telling the story? That's one thing I never ever thought about, actually. Mm. And it's a good point. I looked at Spielberg as being, at that stage, he'd made some really good films.
Yeah.
Even recently, I went back and watched Duel.
I love Duel. How cool
is
Duel?
So do I.
I mean, you're a car guy. It's one of the car movies.
I know. And
the great open road movie that ever was.
I was just as scared watching it the other day as a 54-year-old bloke mm-hmm. as what I was when I was watching it.
Yeah.
And for his debut, I mean, that was incredible.
Yeah.
The imagery, where he put the cameras on the trucks.
And it's so interesting because nothing suggests that he's capable of doing something like this. And then I think this awakens a whole extra prestigious element to his career of like deep emotional stories that like kind of cross barriers. But also it's like that idea of communicating to audiences and things that they should know.
I didn't think he had this dimension in him, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, my son loves a lot of what he did. He was right into the Jurassic Park thing and all that. And that first one I think was brilliant.
Yeah.
But, you know, for him to get into this emotion, it's a real testament. I mean, you know, Jewel.
Yeah.
When I watched it the other night, I said to my wife, I haven't seen it for so long.
Yeah.
We normally take turns in picking our movies. And I said, Jewel.
Yeah.
Let's see this truck.
Yeah. Hey, do you know who did the score for this film?
No.
It's the great Quincy Jones.
Oh, well.
And so for all these blues elements, these gospel elements that he's bringing in as well.
Quincy's amazing.
Have you ever gone back to read Alice Walker's book that this is based on?
No. I normally go one way or the other with a book or a movie.
I love that. Hey, me too.
You know, I choose
movie more than every time, I'd say.
I'm the same.
Yeah.
I'm not a reader.
Yeah.
So I generally stick to what is going on in the movie. But if I was to go back and read it, I reckon it would be surprising.
Yeah.
I reckon it would be. Most things are. But my daughter goes through that thing where she's going through a Stephen King phase at the moment.
Yeah.
And she's reading Pet Sematary.
Oh, yeah. I just read Pet Sematary.
Yeah,
I just read Salem's Lot. They're so wicked.
She's loving it. And he is such a fine writer.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it goes either way. Because I'm not such a big book nerd,
it's
always a movie for me.
Yeah, maybe you would agree with me. I think movies are better than books because they're the same thing, but you've got hot people in them.
Well, that's right. That's right.
It's exciting.
Something
that way.
For the eye.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, not much of the book thing does that, does it?
Yeah. I'll tell you a little bit about the adaptation as well, because Alice Walker was reluctant to turn this into a film because of like Hollywood's history of like not putting like black women and strong black women at the center of films or kind of ignoring them. But she thought the best way to see improvement, to see change, was to work within the system.
Yeah.
And within that system, she stipulated in her contract that she would serve as a project consultant, and that 50% of the production team, aside from the cast as well, would be African American, female, or people of the third world.
Well, see, that's just incredible.
Mm.
And I think what it does is, yes, you have to play within the system.
Yeah.
But what you do is make a change to someone later down the line who's watched this movie, who's going to be African American, they're going to be female.
Yeah.
They're going to come through the ranks and they're going to probably turn around and go, you know what, when I first saw this, I decided I could do this.
Yeah.
Because Whoopi Goldberg was the front and center character of this thing.
Exactly.
And I think that was probably a stroke of brilliance. And to get hold of someone like Spielberg to make it, I think was just another stroke of brilliance too.
Yeah.
Because for him to take it where he took it, I think was just it went somewhere for me.
Yeah.
It wasn't lost.
And I think it holds a lot of power now to this day. Like last year we had a musical remake that came out of this film. Did you get a chance to see that?
No, I didn't. But I remember seeing Oprah talk about
it.
And I got really inspired. But life just got in the way.
Hey, when life finds a chance, you got to jump on it.
You do.
I'd love to see what you think of that film.
I would love to see that.
Before we move on to our next movie, I'd actually love to read you a quote from Spielberg in an interview about the criticism of him being the director, because it's one of the rare times where a director like kind of cops it and talks about it. He says, most of the criticism came from directors that felt that we had overlooked them and that it should have been a black director telling a black story. That was the main criticism. The other criticism was that I softened the book. I've always copped to that. I made the movie I want to make from Alice Walker's book. Alice was on set a lot of the time and could have always stepped in for to say, you know, this is too Disney, this is too that. This is not the way I envisioned the scene going down. She was very supportive during filmmaking, and so I felt that we were doing a good job adapting her novel. There were certain things in the lesbian relationship between Sugar Avery and Seeley that were finely detailed in Alice's book that I didn't feel I could get a PG-13 rating with. And I was shy about it. It was that sense perhaps I was the wrong director to acquit some of the more sexually honest encounters between Sugar and Seeley because I did soften those. Basically, I took something that was extremely erotic and very intentional and I reduced it to a simple kiss. I got a lot of criticism for that.
Well, see, until you brought that up, it was a scene that surprised me as a young bloke. And I was 16 when this came out, right? And
so you're like that target demo that he was trying to go to soften the rating for, basically.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And when you look at the rating here, I mean, gee, you think to yourself, you know, that would be, well, I'd never seen two girls kiss.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
And if it was only down to a kiss, you could allude to whatever it was going to allude to.
Mm.
But I always thought it was very strange, the scene.
Yeah.
But then later on in life, I got it.
Yeah.
Because she'd never been shown any passion.
Mm-hmm.
She was always basically just there as an object.
Yeah.
She'd never been kissed like someone meant to kiss her.
And I was so surprised watching it again because I'd heard all this criticism over the years. And I actually was surprised to see how much was in there because in my head I was like, oh, it's completely erased.
Yeah.
But it's like through looks and through camera and through filmic technique that you're kind of seeing it grow. And I think this film, I feel like, is even better than its reputation lives.
Well, Shug, in the actual movie, had empathy for this beautiful woman.
Yeah.
And realized the trap she was in with Danny. And it's so interesting now you say that.
Yeah.
Because I never saw it that way. I sort of, you brush over things when you're young because it's a little awkward.
Yeah.
But when you look at it as an adult and you go, yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
I get that. She's never been shown that sort of affection.
Yeah.
Her life's been just cut and dried. You're a sex object and you're there when he needs you and that's it. There's no airs and graces with that relationship.
You know? Yeah. It's really moving, powerful stuff.
Oh, yeah. Look, and like I say, that scene where Oprah basically says, I don't need to look after your children. I've got children of my own. And, you know, it was like, and when she gets knocked down and it's very, very heart-wrenching. And I just realized at that time that was what was going on in that day and age.
Yeah.
And we all learned something from it, you know?
Yeah.
I knew the South was hard and we'd watch Roots and things like that, like I said.
Yeah.
But until you see it in a film, it's not romantic. It's hard. Swift justice.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you picked this movie.
Oh, mate, I just love it.
I'm so glad you picked it. We've got one more weekly from you that we'll hit up before we go to our new release title as well.
Yep.
It is the best picture-winning biographical film by Ron Howard. Not John Howard, the opposite kind of guy.
Yes.
About mathematician John Nash, played by Russell Crowe. It is A Beautiful Mind.
Look, I'm a friend of Russell's.
I was going to ask.
And
is this your favorite Russell movie?
It's right up there.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, I just really got engrossed in his character.
It's a great character and it's a beautiful performance.
And he really
right?
turns it on.
Yeah.
And he's got this savant vibe and yet he's got this human touch that I really got drawn into.
Can I tell you what I reckon that human touch is? It is because Russell Crowe, he is such a tough actor and like tough man, masculine man. And I think there's something about casting a guy like that in a role like this that adds this whole extra human dimension to it.
Look, it really did. And it showed another side of Russell as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife made me sit down and go, have you ever seen A Beautiful Mind? I said, look, I haven't because I didn't want to see him in this sensitive role. You know, I wanted to see him in all the old rough and tumble things, you know.
Are you texting him while watching it going like, you're drawing the glass again here.
The next day I said, shit, I actually very moved, you know.
Wow.
And I said to Russell, I said, I hadn't seen A Beautiful Mind and I chucked it on Twitter and I just went, for people who haven't seen this, check it out. Because I said, the character just brings a few things that I had around me as a kid too. I had some kids who were very similar to this at school. I went through St. Al's and there was one particular fellow that really reminded me of Russell's character.
Yeah.
And I think that's what sucked me in. As soon as he, like the first scene, I went, wow, that's this fellow that I went to school with. And he was so brilliant, but not everyone got him because he was just beyond smart.
Do you think this helped you understand that guy more?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Now, this guy wanted to be an air fight pilot, right?
Yeah.
And he gets to
Top Gun stuff.
All that stuff. He gets to the stage where he's able to fly, and then he realizes that he gets some vertigo.
Far out.
And he can't fly. And all his life, this guy that reminded me of this character, he would draw F-111s, and he had his future mapped out from Grafton, you know, and all that. And that's the person this character reminded me of so much.
Yeah.
So it's got a little bit of a personal aspect to it as well.
What did Russell say to you about this film?
When I put up, hey, listen, if you haven't seen this movie, just go and get it.
Yeah.
And I'd say things like, you can thank me later. And then he'd come back and go, one heart at a time. Because that's his favourite saying for when people have discovered a role that you hadn't seen him in. And also a character that I don't think he's played before.
Yeah.
And the understanding of his partner in this whole setup, and then getting to the end as well where they show the bloke and show what he had achieved, and you think to yourself, geez, all that torment that he went through on his journey to get on his path. And straight away I thought of that schoolmate though again.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, he's just, I don't know where he would have ended up, but if you get to a stage where you're about to hit the joystick and you realise you get bad vertigo, that's dreams gone.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, so every time he would pretty much open his mouth, I could see this fella.
Wow. I mean, that's the power of cinema, brother. That's what I believe in. And sometimes it's a silver screen that reflects back your own life, mate.
That's the reason I picked this movie.
Yeah.
Is because, I mean, not only do I think Russell's a really wonderful actor. I mean, I sometimes, even lately we've been co-writing a couple of songs together, which has been great fun. But he'll talk about how, oh, look, I'll let you go. I've got to go and learn 10 pages of dialogue.
Far out.
10 pages of dialogue.
Yeah.
He said, and then I'm going to go and have a swim and play some tennis, and then I'll be ready for the set tomorrow.
Wow.
And I think to myself, what a skill set that is.
Yeah.
The dialogue in this is long.
Yeah.
It's intricate, very, very deep and well thought out. And I always held that in a really, really high regard as I was watching him too, thinking, how the hell do you remember the eons of dialogue that are coming and going in your mind and act at the same time and not look like you're remembering lines?
Well, I mean, that's what you do on stage when you're singing. That's a lot of lines that you have to remember as well.
Nothing like that.
I reckon you could do it.
No.
Oh, yeah, we're going to make a beautiful mind around you as well.
I've had this conversation with different people, but I do really hold the proper actor, like Russell, in high regard because of that. I don't know how you retain those sorts of things. I can retain lyrics all right.
Yeah.
And I have done since I was a kid.
You've written a lot of them as well.
Written a lot too.
They've come out of your head in the first place.
And listening to John Denver or listening to Charlie Pride and all that, it all retained in there pretty good. But having to recite lines back while cameras are rolling around you and people are waiting on you.
Yeah.
That gives me real anxiety.
Yeah.
And I was getting anxiety watching some of the lines he was putting out.
Wow. You're an empath like me. You can't help but feel it, man.
I was thinking, how does he do this? And how is he delivering this character the way he is? And it's a hard one to pull off.
Yeah, it is. And he won an Oscar for it.
Well, he did. And for me, I purposely chose it, I think, because I think it would be the top of the mountain as far as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of people could pull that off.
Yeah.
Not a lot.
Do you think I could do it?
I reckon you could.
Okay.
Yeah.
I need that right role.
Oh, yeah,
I need that right role to take me to the next level.
But, you know, I'd be the sort of the good acting that I could do is maybe a little cameo where you walk into a bar and you got three lines.
Okay, I'd that love would do to me. See that.
These pretzels.
What would your three lines? Pretzels? Okay.
Are making me thirsty.
Okay, there we go. We've got a Seinfeld. We've got a Seinfeld. I think we could give you a Seinfeld-style sitcom.
No, look, I do really respect this end of town.
Yeah.
I really do. And it's only because I just don't think I can do it.
Wow. Okay.
It's weird, isn't it?
I think we've got to give it a shot, though.
Oh, well.
Yeah. That's your next act.
He hasn't asked yet, anyway. We'll see how we go.
a team up between you and Russell.
Yeah, but I
two mathematicians collaborating together. That's a movie.
Yeah, look, I do think that really was a big climb for Russell, and it was worth every minute of watching it. And my wife and I, when we watched it maybe a month or so ago, were still in awe of that character.
Yeah,
I don't know. It just he sucked us in completely.
Oh, I love to hear that. Yeah. Hey, before we move on to your overnight title, I'd love to ask you, usually I talk to people about like the video stores they went to growing up and stuff, but you grew up in Grafton, a place I spent a lot of time in.
Yep.
I have so many memories going to one of my favorite cinemas in the whole country, the Saraton Cinema. Wow, yeah. Have you had great experiences there as well? Is that where you discovered a lot of films?
Well, I sure have. Bit of nostalgia. Saraton is notorious backwards.
Absolutely.
And that was the great local
Greek immigrant family, yes, you know?
Beautiful people. They sold the actual building to the council for a dollar.
Wow.
And then the council came up with the money to restore it. And
it's beautifully restored.
It is incredible. Everything was not a stone unturned.
Yeah.
And taken back to original. And saw many a movie, saw many a live concert there, saw Goanna there.
Oh, great.
On their Spirit of Place tour when it first came out. Saw Don McLean, saw Rodney Rood, everyone.
My God, that's the full gamut, those three.
Pretty much. And then to top it off, played quite a few shows of my own going through there. But in the height of COVID, we had an offer to do a Jacaranda Festival in the Saraton Theatre with myself and Ian Moss.
Oh, my God. This is like the Grafton trifecta happening right now.
I know. And I said to Ian, I said, if we can get over the border, because he was up in Queensland with me, and get our paperwork in order and get to this gig, it'll be a miracle. But it was almost sold out to the nosebleeds. And for me to bring someone like Ian Moss back home to my hometown is like bringing the king back.
Yeah.
And Chisel through Don Walker have quite big connections to that town, Flame Trees.
Mm-hmm.
So Ian and I are in the Saraton Theatre and he starts Flame Trees on the guitar. You could hear a pin drop and then by about the third line, everyone's in. Wow. And I'm sitting there going, well, this is just like the pinch me moment right now.
Wow.
And, you know, I love the song.
Full circle.
Yeah, yeah. Here I was as a kid watching my favourite bands there.
Mm-hmm.
But here we are on stage together with just two acoustic guitars. And once he started Flame Trees and the crowd started singing, it was something else. It was our first ever show of that whole tour.
Yeah.
And we started in Grafton and we finished in Alice Springs, his hometown.
Wow.
So full circle. But completely self-indulgent for me.
Hey, you're allowed a little bit of hubris every now and then, bro. A little bit of that ego, you're allowed it.
I would hope so. But yeah, Notaris Mills, they said the town had been so good to them.
Mm-hmm.
They happily sold it for $1 and said, do it up.
God damn, I would have bought it for $2. They should have come to me first.
Me too. So it's a great story.
New release.
Well, there's another great story here, the one held in your overnight title, The Drover's Wife. I absolutely adore this film, The Drover's Wife, The Legend of Molly Johnson. I was hoping you would pick out a Western film, and I was hoping that would be an Australian Western film, but I got to tell you how delighted I was that the Western film you chose counters nearly a century of male-centric and largely whitewashed genre, both in Australia and in Hollywood. And this film is a directorial debut by one of Australia's best actors, Lea Purcell. What made you pick The Drover's Wife?
I'd been needing an excuse to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it needed to be within the last, you know, recent times.
Mm-hmm.
I get scared of watching certain things because I find them confronting some historical things, especially to do with First Nations people. So it was my excuse to go and have a look.
Yeah.
And I've been wanting to see it. I love Lea, but I was just scared of how confronting it was going to be to me. I still haven't been able to watch Rabbit Proof Fence.
Mm.
I saw the first little snippets of it, and it was too heart-wrenching for me. Mm. So I went straight away, bang, week and a half ago, and I thought, I'm watching it. I watched half of it, and I thought, I'm going to leave it.
Yeah.
I need it to settle in. I need to see where Molly is sitting as the character. And then to see the emotion that Lea Purcell put into that character, the huskiness of her voice when she was crying, it was almost like I was there. the landscape,
mm.
the coal country, the big trees, those big snowy river gums.
Oh,
I fucking love them. And I just got totally immersed in her struggle. And I really felt for the local copper, the sergeant that went out there as well
mm.
with his wife. And his wife was trying to break down the stereotypes of women are just there as objects. There that you can abuse them, you can do what you want with them. We're basically in the Wild West here.
Yeah.
And we are the boss. We've got the guns. And if the black people play up, we'll kill them, that sort of thing. It was pretty much frontier war, colonial times.
Mm.
And it's times where I really did feel like, I must admit, I was crying a little bit on the plane yesterday.
Yeah, of course.
When I pulled up here.
It's a misty-eyed movie, this one.
It is. And I felt for the kids. I felt for her and the abuse she faced. And I really did feel like I hope there's a way out.
Yeah.
You're just wishing in your heart of hearts that there's a way out for her. And, you know, all the characters, the other fellow that played the other Aboriginal lad who was running around, who was the murderer,
mm-hmm.
who she befriended, I really loved his role.
Yeah.
I loved his role and his involvement with her oldest son, you know, promising to take him on some men's business where yeah. he could show him the ways of the bush, show him how to throw a spear, teach him about the stars and all that.
Yeah.
And that really got me in too, because I just do love that tip of the hat to culture as well.
And we've begun this conversation talking about like that sense of belonging to country and how it's like interpreted through art. And I think the way this film accesses that feeling is quite sensational, because it uses like filmic technique to get there. Instead of having like these establishing shots of just like, oh, it's the house that we're looking at, it's these shots that are like, Australia has a great landscape and it's detailed through history, in film history forever.
Yeah.
But the way this film captures them, it feels really unique. Like these grand yet detailed nature photography. You've got these cascading clouds over landscape that you don't, I don't think I've ever seen anything like that before. And that kind of brings you in and lets you feel place. And then the other one that got me, something you even mentioned, you've got these close-ups of frost melting on plants as they expand in the morning sun. And I think it's just those little details like that that let you feel the setting, feel the place, and bring you into it.
There were some time-lapse things that really got me in.
Yes.
I love time-lapse.
It's that time-lapse stuff.
There was an old tree. It just looked like an old man's face. Mm. It's craggy. But there was a little bit of something hanging on it like yeah. this, and it was swinging. That's the only thing that gave it away,
yeah.
that it was a time-lapse. And it was a vision. And I'm sure that, you know, Leah saw this vision, and she saw the country. She's not from that area,
mm.
but she made us believe she was.
She understood it.
There was yeah. this beautiful spiritual thing of sweeping the dirt in the dark.
Mm.
And my nan was very superstitious, and she wouldn't even sweep dirt out of the house
yeah.
on dusk, because she would say that would coax ghosts. And I saw that part of what she was doing with that broom as being a real spiritual connection to something.
Mm.
And whether it be Irish people are also very superstitious as well. So when Irish people mixed it up with Aboriginal people,
mm.
a lot of superstitions.
Yeah.
A lot of things that some people wouldn't allow you to whistle. My nan didn't like whistling after dark.
Mm.
Things like that, you know, simple stuff. But what I saw in Molly was this will to survive at any cost.
Mm.
And she was going to be there for her kids regardless. And, I mean, that sergeant, you know, was doing his job, trying to protect the frontier.
Yeah.
Whereas he didn't realise, his wife did, but he didn't realise how hard women had it.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a woman that came from a black woman and a white man, and the struggles they had as being called half-caste, quarter-caste, you know, all the octoroon or whatever they called them. And it was just fascinating to see that end of town captured like that
mm.
because I hadn't seen pioneer sort of a movie like that for a long time.
And I would say it's got a beautiful score. It's from a first-time composer, Saliana Seven Campbell. It's a raw film with this rich and edgy score that embraces and reflects that. And I've got this quote from her: "Fiddles, banjos, mandolins, piano, electric guitars. I'm also proud to say, except for two guitar solos and a double bass, I played all the instruments on the soundtrack."
Did she?
Yeah, how cool is that?
Well, I was totally blown away.
Yeah.
The fiddles were phenomenal. Phenomenal. They sounded really true, folky. She's probably classically trained.
Yeah.
But the good thing is she's actually got a chance to pull out something in her that's probably lived in there for a long time.
Yeah.
And she's written the score, but the beauty of it is she's been allowed to play like something else.
Oh, yeah.
And she's allowed herself.
And it's like without melody, it kind of just is, it's really beautiful.
The banjo was astounding. The electric guitar was astounding. The double bass was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there. My wife walked over. She was cooking dinner when I was watching the first half of the movie. And she said, "That soundtrack is nice."
Yeah.
I said, "I'd buy the soundtrack."
Hey, alone. You can. You know should. What
I mean? Oh, definitely.
We'll give that to you too in the bundle that you're picking up.
That sounds great.
Staff pick. One other thing I'm going to give you is a staff pick recommendation based on your taste and the beautiful choices you've got here today. And because I was so excited about you picking out a Western film, I really got thinking about it. So I was trying to think about like Westerns and then also this idea of like revisionist Westerns. Westerns that kind of take away that whitewashing, that take away that that kind of Hollywood-centric feeling to them. And I've thought of a couple of classics, but the first one I wanted to give to you is not unlike The Preacher's Wife. It's the directorial debut of one of the greatest actors of all time. I'm not sure if you've seen this one before, but it's a classic Western called Buck and the Preacher, starring and directed by Sidney Poitier? Alongside no. Harry Belafonte.
Wow.
So have you seen this film before?
No, I have not. No.
Oh, man, you're going to absolutely love this because I'm all about kind of like restructuring the canon. And this film, it kind of feels like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, but it's about so much more. It's so much deeper and more complex. You've got two of the great kind of people that are heading up the civil rights movement in America.
Yeah.
Leading this in this kind of like a buddy, like Western buddy genre type film. But it's all about these two people that join forces in order to take on white bounty hunters threatening a westward bound caravan of people that have been recently emancipated from slavery. So they're going through country trying to find like
Where they belong. Yes.
And the other kind of current that's been going through your choices is this idea of strong women.
Yes.
And this film also features one of another great actor, Ruby Dee, who's in like Do the Right Thing. She's an American Gangster.
Yep.
And this is an early performance of hers that she kind of plays. She plays Sidney Poitier's wife, and she is the emotional core of this film, like kind of what keeps this film together. And then it's all about them becoming, I guess, bank robbers together to fund their way through. And when I think about like bank robbery films and heist films, they are social justice films. They're films about taking what does not belong to other people and keeping it and making your own richness or your freedom with it, rather. Not richness. Well, richness of soul, richness and self, richness of like currency.
Totally.
Yeah.
It would have been so easy to pick a couple of other movies, but I think something like this is really something I should see. Because, I mean, seeing these two in different roles have always been inspiring for us.
Yeah.
Just to see people who can do it and to give you the inspiration to go, wow. You know, I used to look at Harry Belafonte and he always reminded me of my pop.
Yeah.
So it's just a wonderful way to look at it and go, I can learn something from this too.
Yeah. And it's interesting because they also, like, another thing that they kind of tackle in this revisionist type of Western is the relationship between Black Americans and Native Americans.
Yeah.
And how, you know, they are both at odds with like the white culture and the white people have taken over their land. And now, but in a way there, it tackles something really difficult, which is that Black people also fought against the Native people.
That's right.
And it's some, I've never seen it addressed in a film before. And watching this film, it's like as a really powerful moment where you have them meeting because they need permission to cross land and to cross through country. And I don't think there's anything quite like it in a Western, especially from one like in this 1970s period.
That is a really unique situation. It's one I've never seen.
Yeah.
So that's awesome.
Well, that's in there for you. You can find that movie basically everywhere now because it's got this new restoration. It's out there in the world.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Hey, my pleasure. Troy, thank you so much for joining me
It's been
man.
A pleasure. What a great shop. It's just like the old the Jacaranda,
Jacaranda
video shop that I used to go to.
Yeah.
So nice to be able to see tangible things again.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's all online. I know I buy a lot of things. I always buy movies still on Apple iTunes.
I love that.
Because I think to myself, $14.95 is not a big amount in the scheme of things to make a movie.
And to own art in some kind of way.
Exactly, exactly. Hey. So I'm old school like that.
I love the old school star, brother. I love that old school star.
Yeah, I love it.
Man, thank you very
much. Thank you very much,
too. Come back anytime, man. Anytime.
Awesome. I loved every minute of that. The last video store.